Interruptions can be so infuriating, can't they? Now, sometimes we can handle interruptions, like when we're not on a tight schedule or there's nothing urgent going on, but that's not when interruptions come, are they? They always come at the worst possible time, when we're in a hurry, when we've got our schedule filled to the rim, when we have the least time to cope with them. Or the truth is, interruptions are always there. We just really know about them when we're stressed and rushed, and they seem to get in the way. Now, if the interruptions themselves were the whole problem, life wouldn't be so bad. But interruptions tend to bring other problems, such as resentment. We get attitudes like, "Why me, Lord? Why now? Come on, really? Is this really happening right now? Don't people realize I have important things to do?" Interruptions can breed irritation, which looks and sounds a lot like resentment. Truth is, though, bottom line, people are more important than things. And if you break down the interruptions in our days, more often than not, they're people that are interrupting. And oftentimes, it's people that are getting away in the way of our plans, our agendas, our expectations. And sometimes, if we're not careful, those feelings of irritation and even resentment can be directed toward the people who interrupt our schedule. And we got to be careful about that, because people are more important than things, like our schedule and our agenda. And that is something we see in the life of Christ. Jesus worked hard. His schedule was often very full. But you'll notice Jesus was never in a hurry. He was never running at a feverish pace. He had time for people. There are instances where it seems he spent a lot of time with one person. Think of the woman at the well in Samaria. One person took up a lot of his time. But for Jesus, that was worth it. These one-on-one interactions show us a lot about his priorities and how he would make time for what was really important. 55 years ago, Charles Hummel published a small booklet. It was entitled Tyranny of the Urgent. Widely hailed in business as well as Christian circles for its innovative take on time management, the book is really about priorities. The author related how an experienced factory worker manager once told him, "Your greatest danger is letting the urgent things crowd out the important." Let me say that again. Your greatest danger is letting the urgent things crowd out the important. That statement really stuck with him. He went on to write, "We live in constant tension between the urgent and the important. The problem is that many important tasks need not be done today or even this week. You know, spending time in prayer and Bible study, a visit to an elderly friend, reading an important book, these activities can usually wait a while longer. But often urgent, though less important tasks call for an immediate response. Endless demands pressure every waking hour." And I'm sure we all know what that pressure feels like. We have busy lives. We're under the gun. We've got to get some things accomplished. Things have to be done. And these things keep getting in the way. And honestly, a lot of those interruptions have faces and names. They're people. Individuals' needs can seemingly get in the way. And the question is it urgent or is it important? And what is often true is that what we want to do seems very urgent in our minds. My agenda is very urgent. but people are important. And we have to find that balance so that we are not so tied up in what we consider to be urgent that we don't have time for the needs of others. Jesus always did. No matter how busy he was, no matter how full his schedule was, people came first. And we see that in particular in the story we're going to look at from Luke chapter 8. We're considering Jesus and the interrupting. We find not only once but twice in this passage, Jesus is interrupted by someone. And how he handled that, I think, has great lessons for us as well. We begin in Luke chapter 8, verse 40, with the expectant crowd. There's always a crowd around Jesus, isn't there? And this was also true in this setting. Luke chapter 8, verse 40. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. You might say, returned from what? Well, remember last week they had gone across the lake into the region of the Gerasenes? It was a Gentile area. Jesus encountered a man who was possessed by a number of demons living in the graveyard. He was wild and crazy. And Jesus cast the demons out. They went into a herd of pigs that ran down into the lake and drowned. Remember that story? Well, he's coming back from that. Coming back across the lake. Because remember, after all that happened, the people of the region said, "Hey, Jesus, that was really cool, but get out. We don't want you here. Leave." So he went back. And when he got back, there was a crowd. You know, he had left the shores of Capernaum to escape the crowds. But in that interval, there had been a storm that had come up on the lake that he calmed. When he got to the other side, he encountered that man possessed by the demons. He was asked to leave. Now he comes back. There really wasn't much rest and relaxation there, was there? And once again, here's the crowds. And they're expecting him. They're expecting miracles. They're expecting teachings. They're expecting Jesus. I'm sure his disciples are thinking, "Oh man, crowd of people with expectations." But the crowd kind of fades into the distance as we see an individual emerge. Verse 41 and 42, we're told of the emerging crisis. Just then a man named Jairus, a ruler of the synagogue, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. One man fights his way through the crowd in order to get to Jesus. Now, my guess is the townsfolk would have recognized him. This man was an important person in the community. He is called a ruler of the synagogue. But he has a very desperate look on his face. Now, the ruler of the synagogue in those days, he was an official who was responsible for arranging the worship at the synagogue. He would select people who would lead in prayer, select who would read the scriptures, even select those who would preach. So he was a prominent man in the community. He would have been, in our terms, an elder or deacon in the church. But Jairus did not approach Jesus as a distinguished figure. He came as a desperate father, frantic to find help for his 12-year-old girl. No doubt by this point, father had called everyone he could think of, but no one was answering his 911 calls. There just wasn't anybody there. He's desperate, but he hasn't given up yet. Unfortunately, the most learned physicians couldn't help her. So he swallows his pride, kneels at the feet of Jesus, begging him to come. And notice how there's this crowd around, but it's like the crowd fades into the background. And with Jesus, there's just one. He's able to focus all of his attention on the one person who may have interrupted his plans. I don't know what Jesus had on his agenda for this day, but at that moment, this became the agenda. And Jesus goes with him. You notice that Jesus has like a zoom lens where he can filter out everybody else, and that one person gets all of his attention. And that was his priority. For him, that's what was important. The crowd may have been urgent, but the one was important. Next, we see another interruption. What I am calling the enlightening compassion. And it's enlightening to us, but I'm sure at the time there may have been another word Jairus would have used to describe it. I'm sure Jairus is feeling rather elated as Jesus agrees to come to his house. Now, progress would have been very slow. Verse 42 says that the crowd was almost crushing Jesus. You just imagine this throng of people trying to move toward Jairus' house, probably down a narrow street, and there people are jostling each other, and you know, you have 10 people trying to fit in an aisle that's 8 people wide. You know, so there's a lot of commotion that's going on, like an ambulance stuck in a traffic jam. Jairus' frustration must have been climbing. You know, you can almost hear him saying, "Come on, people, clear the way. My daughter's life is on the line here." And suddenly the procession stops. Now, my guess is Jairus probably walked ahead several steps before he realized nobody else was moving, because Jesus had stopped. Why did Jesus stop? Well, we see in verse 43. A woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately the bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." Now, when you first hear that story, you think, wow, this is great. You know, great for this woman. Kind of a interesting demonstration of faith here, but you know, it's honored and she's healed. Wow, that's awesome. But try to imagine this through Jairus's eyes, right? You know, Jairus is getting Jesus to come, and finally there's hope for his daughter. I hope we're not too late. She's right on the brink of death. Come on, Jesus, let's go. Crowd, get out of the way. Come on, we have important things here. And suddenly Jesus stops and says, incredibly, of all things, "Who touched me?" Peter's like, who didn't touch you? I mean, come on. This crowd, everybody's just, you know, jostling each other. Of course you've been touched. Why are you asking that? And he says, no. Somebody touched me. Somebody reached out intentionally and touched me, because I could feel my supernatural power flowing out of me. Isn't that amazing? Jesus could know when someone came up behind him. And when it says it touched his cloak, a lot of times I've seen pictures there. It's, you know, the woman's laying on the ground. She's just barely reaching the bottom hem of his robe. That's probably not what it was. Literally, the Greek there says tassel. And men in those days would wear a tassel that would hang down about the middle of the back. And likely that is what she reached out and touched. But he stops. And even though that must have been very frustrating to Jairus, here's another interruption. Here is another important person that seems to be getting in the way of another important person, and yet Jesus stops what he's doing. Now think about it, and I'm sure Jairus did. Why can't you come back and talk to her later? You know, go heal my daughter, then you can come back and settle this with this person. Why are you stopping now? But Jesus stopped. That woman was just as important to Jesus as Jairus' little daughter. I don't want to make too much of this, but did you notice in the passage? She had had this condition of uninterrupted bleeding for as long as the little girl had been alive, 12 years in both instances. And we think, you know, this would have been a problem. You know, it's not really come across as life-threatening. It certainly would have been inconvenient to be, you know, constantly bleeding. Understand, back then, when a woman was bleeding, she was considered unclean. She couldn't go worship at the synagogue or the temple. She could not even be around anybody else. In fact, you notice a bit of embarrassment in her reply. If the people had known that this unclean woman was working through the crowd to touch Jesus, everyone she touched became ceremonially unclean. And she had lived with this for 12 years. And Jesus saw that she was just as important as the person he was going to minister to. And he stops. And he says, "Who touched me?" Again, the people around her thinking, "Jesus, come on. Everybody has touched you." Now, did Jesus really not know? Of course not. He knew. He's Jesus. He's the Son of God. It's kind of like when in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had hid themselves, remember? They're hiding behind trees in the garden. God comes along, says, "Adam, where are you?" Did God really not know where Adam was? Of course he did. He wanted Adam to admit where he was. Same here. Jesus wanted the woman to come out and admit what had happened. You say, why? For one thing, if you look at this from her perspective, her faith had a little bit of superstition behind it, didn't it? If I just touch Jesus' clothing, I'll be healed. That's a little superstitious, isn't it? Almost magical. And people to this day are using that same idea. I don't know if they're still doing it, but I know for a while these TV preachers would say, "Send me money and I'll send you a hanky I blew my nose in," or something, I don't know. "And if you touch it, you'll be healed." Whatever. That's superstition, that's magic, that's not Christian. But there's an element of that in this woman's faith. You know, "Oh, if I just touch his garment." You say, "Well, it worked, didn't it?" Yeah, it did. But what was it that worked? Was it the physical act of touching the tassel? No, Jesus makes it very clear, your faith has made you well. And I think one of the reasons why Jesus stopped and made this woman come out and admit what had happened was so that he could be very clear. This isn't a magic show. There's nothing superstitious about this. It's your faith that has made you well. And curiously, the word here for healed or made you well, in the Greek it's the word sozo, which means saved. Literally, Jesus says, your faith has saved you. That's important. Because not only was the woman healed from that physical ailment, her soul was saved. Why? Because we are saved by grace through faith. And even though her faith was not perfect, even though her faith was not maybe what we would consider orthodox, it was the faith in Jesus that saved her. And it's just one of those reminders that we don't have to have perfect faith. We don't have to have great faith. We just need to have faith in a great God. That's what saves. And that's what this woman had. And I believe Jesus wanted to point that out to her and to the crowd so that there's no misunderstanding. This isn't a magic show. Jesus isn't playing sleight of hand or anything else. This is operational by faith. And that faith not only healed her of her bleeding, her faith saved her. And then he uses the word, he says, go in peace. That word peace is shalom. Be well. Not only are you physically healed, but your whole person has been saved. And that woman was important enough to Jesus to stop what he was doing, to stop the very important mission that he was on, to make sure she understood what had happened to her. Now let's get back to Jairus. Can you imagine he's just behind Jesus' shoulder like this, tapping his foot? All right, Jesus, come on, let's go. All right, yeah, got that. Let's go, come on. You got something very important you got to do. And then a messenger comes from Jairus' house. This is the eventual conclusion of the story. I'm sure this whole exchange must have been very exciting for everybody there except Jairus. He's like, come on, let's go. We got to go. And then verse 49, while Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Try to put yourself in the sandals of Jairus for just a moment. How would you have felt? Jesus, are you serious? This woman had been suffering for 12 years. Another 30 minutes wouldn't have mattered. Yeah, you could have come back to her after you had gone and healed my daughter. There's a sense of urgency there. We got to do this right now. What are you thinking, Jesus? And notice the messenger's lack of faith. He say, it's too late. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Sickness is one thing, death is another. We have a saying in the fire service, you can't fix dead. And I'm sure that's what the people were thinking at the time. Well, too late. You know, it's nice for this woman, but too bad for that little girl. It's too late. That fact must have hit Jairus like a sledgehammer. Jesus, though, says to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed. Now again, we don't see it in our English translation, but in the original language, that last word in the verse is sozo. Just believe and your daughter will be saved. Completely restored. Jesus is challenging Jairus to act in faith, regardless of how things appear, regardless of what everybody else is saying. The same faith that healed that woman would save his little girl. Sickness or death doesn't matter. The results would be the same. And then we read the eventual conclusion, beginning in verse 51. When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, James, and John, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She's not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Jesus goes in, raises the girl. He is the resurrection and the life. He can raise the dead. This isn't the only time he proved that point. But I want you to notice something that Luke doesn't point out specifically, but it's there. Jairus had faith. Jairus could have said to Jesus, "Well, sorry to have bothered you. Go on your way. It's too late." Just like the messenger had said. Jairus could have given up. Jairus could have gotten angry. "Jesus, I can't believe you let this woman get in the way of my little girl. Now she's dead. I'm done with you." He didn't do that. He said, "Come on, let me show you the way." And his faith opened the door for Jesus to come in and raise his little girl. Now, we see here, as in other occasions, Jesus tells the parents not to tell anyone. You say, how's this going to be kept quiet? I mean, there's this huge crowd, right? You know, Jairus was a very well-known individual. How is this going to stay quiet? I'm not so sure in this case it was so much about keeping the news quiet as it was, don't be so caught up in the fanfare of all this. Take care of your daughter. Your daughter's 12. She doesn't need to be a celebrity. She doesn't need to be paraded around town and say, "Hey, look what happened." You take care of her needs. Give her something to eat. She had been sick for a while. She probably hadn't eaten for some time. She needed her strength to be built back up. Again, Jesus is focusing on the girl. He could have taken her around and said, "Look what I did." He wasn't interested in that. He was interested in her well-being. And he told his parents, her parents, to do the same. Publicity was not necessary at this time. So, what do we learn from this event in the life of Jesus? How do we handle the interruptions in our lives? I think it's all a matter of perspective. See, it's very easy for us to view interruptions as distractions from real life when we're in a hurry. I mean, if we've got our schedule so stacked that anything that comes up is a break in our agenda, we may be missing some of God's best opportunities. And since interruptions are unavoidable, and we might as well admit it, maybe it'd be wise to build into our schedules some extra room for interruptions. I remember a Bible college professor who happened to be a minister at the time telling us, "You need to schedule interruptions." And I'm thinking, how do you do that? I mean, you don't know when they're coming. And his point was, don't book every minute of every day so tightly that you don't have time for people, because people are the most important. They may not be the most urgent, but they are the most important. And we need to make room for God's interruptions in our agenda. Jesus was on his way for a very urgent mission to heal a very sick daughter. And how focused he must have been on that. A precious young life hung in the balance, and many who followed him could see the miracle and believe. An influential father would likely become a convert, but he stopped in the middle of that pressing crowd and responded to another very important matter that had interrupted his progress. He took time for the woman who had suffered 12 long years. Did Jesus care less about Jairus and his daughter? No. But he cared enough about that woman to give him her full attention at that time. How unlike many pastors and other Christian leaders who are programmed, really, to be executives first and to be shepherds of a flock only at a distance second. Let's remember, people are never an interruption in our ministry. They are the ministry. If you're too busy to meet the needs of a hurting congregation when they need you, you're too busy to be a pastor. Our Lord was never that busy, and the servant is not greater than his Lord, nor is his schedule ever more important than others. I'm convinced that when our public ministry is over, our private ministry is going to be what's most remembered. You know, sermons and ceremonies, they're important at the time, but it's those moments spent with individuals, maybe in that waiting room, or that ICU ward, or maybe in a funeral home. Those times when you pray with someone, those times when you show the love of Jesus to someone else, that's going to mean more than any sermon you ever preach. People are always more important. You see, even though Jesus was constantly surrounded by expectant crowds and urgent needs, he lived life with a zoom lens. When someone stood in front of Jesus, time stopped. Everything else in his life, all his concerns, his agenda, his goals, blurred and disappeared. He was fully attentive to that one. One at a time is the way of Jesus changing the world. The important supersedes the urgent. Nothing is more important than people. That was Jesus' agenda, and I would suggest it should be ours as well. Would you bow with me as we close? Lord Jesus, we thank you that in your eyes, the needs of the one could supersede the needs of the many. And you still operate that way today. Each one is important to you. Help us to see that each one we encounter is just important to us. May we learn from this. May we take it with us. May we see the interruptions in our schedules and agendas as your divine appointments. And may we respond in the same love and compassion and concern that you did. Help us to put this into practice.